Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hello, Behind the Headlines fans. This is the season one recap of Behind the Headlines, the score of Behind the Headlines. I am the executive producer of the series, Tony Gill, and along with me is writer and researcher and lawyer and radio host and author and writer and blogger.
Wow. That's a lot of stuff.
Julie DeCaro. You do a lot of stuff. You do a lot of things.
I haven't blogged for a long time, although those were like the salad days with being a blogger. That's the most fun in media you can have.
But yes, we are finally here at the end of the season. It took us a long time to get here, but we thought we were only going to do six episodes, but it turned out to be, this will be the ninth episode, I guess, of the series.
So when we started tossing this around back in, like, what, November, we came up with this topic. Mm-hmm. Did you ever think we would get access to the information we got access to?
No, especially early on. Side note, like, this is kind of like behind the scenes things that goes on when you're, you know, booking guests.
Pulling back the curtain.
Pulling back the curtain on this. A lot of people were like, nah, I'm good.
Yeah.
You know,
didn't want to be involved.
And that was very discouraging early on. So that was the starting point of the podcast. But once we got past that, as people saw, like, and listened to the first episode and how they liked it and how it was going to be objective look at the entire case, I feel like we were just finding information and people were giving information.
Yeah, it's amazing how people will just give you things if you mm-hmm. ask for them. I mean, it's like the hardest thing I think in journalism is just reaching out to people you don't know and being like, hey, could I get access to this? And you'd be surprised at how often people say yes. Mm-hmm. But like early in the beginning, I was afraid we were just going to be like reading articles other people had written and being like summarizing them. Like,
right.
I couldn't, honestly, to be honest,
I thought that was, I was scared that was going to happen.
Right.
That all of our information would be secondhand,
right,
and third hand, and then we wouldn't be able to get any firsthand knowledge. And I know from, I'm an avid, and you are an avid podcast listener, that's not as intriguing to me. It's like, well, I could just go read the
other journalistically sound. I mean, so, you know, Dan Wiederer wrote this great piece for the Chicago Tribune last summer that sort of kicked this whole thing off.
We tried to get him, but schedules didn't work out, and he was just extremely busy.
Yeah.
And things like that.
Well, really, we wanted Dan to be the guy who, like, set the whole thing up, because mm-hmm. we both read that piece and were like, wow, this would be a great podcast topic. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, shout out to Dan Wiederer for putting both this on our radars and a lot of other people's radars with that terrific piece in the Tribune.
Thank you, Dan, for writing. And he was working with somebody. I can't remember.
Stacey St. Clair.
Stacey, yes. So thank you guys for writing that very, very interesting piece. And I'm sorry we couldn't work it out where we couldn't get them on. It would have been great to have them on, but it just didn't work out.
Yeah, it would have been great. I was really worried. We're just going to be doing this thing where we read part of what someone else wrote and then Tony and I talk about it for 30 minutes. And so when we started being able to get access to documents, court mm-hmm. documents, when we started getting access to people who had been involved in the case, and then people were reaching out to us and saying they want to talk. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, Daniel Green reached out to us via direct message mm-hmm. on Twitter through a friend and said, you know, I'd really like to talk and tell my side of the story. So it's kind of amazing how once you start putting this stuff out there, it can snowball and stuff just starts coming to you. I'm a little concerned that this was like the like a unicorn case, you know, where like we got access to all this information and it's never going to happen like this mm-hmm. for us again. But I guess we'll see what happens next season.
Yeah, it was. Let's start from the beginning and then work our way up to the ending of it. The planning of this was extensive.
And also very haphazard.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like so fast.
Yeah, it was from where we started, where it was just us outside of the radio station talking about, you know, different things that, you know, we can add or contribute to the station and stuff that we wanted to do. We were like, well, why can't we? you know, and then you made a full PowerPoint for our boss, Mitch Rosen, about how it was going to go
with a picture
about.
Of you I've in
never,
it, by the way.
I've never seen that PowerPoint yet.
There's a picture of you in it.
I would like to see
it's
that
amazing.
PowerPoint, if you still have it.
I do. I have it. I'll send it to you.
I would like to see that. But he greenlit it.
Yeah.
And thought it was a good idea. And I thought it was a great idea.
Yeah. And I think the support of Mitch Rosen as far as, and also Keith Sergilia over at radio.com or Entercom, I don't even know. There's a lot of different entities going on here. Yeah. Anyway, them, you know, they're helping us push it out and being really supportive of it. And, you know, for a while, we thought the only way we'd be able to interview Daniel was in prison and not on the phone. And they were like, go,
yeah,
you know,
fully,
get a ticket. Like,
fully prepared to send you. I don't know if they were going to send me. But they were fully prepared to send you to go down there. And when I saw that email exchange where Keith and Mitch, they were like all in on this, I was like, wow, like the support was crazy. They checked it out. They listened to it. They enjoyed it. It wasn't just about, oh, here's some more content. There you go. They actually wanted the quality of the content to be, you know, at peak. And once it was, they were full on board with it.
Yeah, and the thing that was so crazy, the reason we wound up doing everything so quickly is because we, you know, working in radio, we're used to just taking audio clips from whoever we want and using them however we want.
Oh, yeah.
And so Tony puts together this terrific first episode with all this audio from like the NBA Finals and James Jordan talking to Ahmad Rashad and Michael Jordan talking to Oprah. And then our bosses come back and are like, did you get permission to use all this audio? And we're like, no, why? And then you have to go get information or get permission from every single person.
Yeah. Yeah,
to use that. So, like, Oprah said no. The NBA said no.
Yeah.
The only person who said yes to us was the guy who wrote Be Like Mike, which was, like, I thought he'd be the last person to say yes.
Yeah.
The guy who wrote the jingle Be Like Mike is like, yeah, go ahead. You can use it. But, like, nobody else. We were talking to, like, Oprah's people and stuff. And so it took us so long to get permission and to get audio that we could use, that once once we dropped episode one, then it was, like, just a sprint.
Yeah, I still have that episode, the very first one, and it was, I gotta say, I'm very, very critical of my work. If anything that I produce, I'm very critical of it, but that first episode.
It was great. This is better than cereal. Look at all the stuff he's got in here.
It was so great, and I may put that out on my own.
You should.
On my own thing.
You should.
Like,
just don't
it's
get
like
sued.
The edited version of it. I'm like, I'm not making money off it. It's like, listen, people, look what I mixed together and stuff like that. So.
And so he's having to strip. Every time I send Tony an email saying, Oprah's people won't let us use this, NBA won't let us use this, he's like having to strip off layers of his of his producing, and it's just like his heart is breaking over the line. I can feel it over text.
It's like an artist. You feel like you create a masterpiece, and they're like, nope, you got to strip all of that away. And you're just left with the bare bones of it. And fortunately, it still came out all right.
It did.
And people still enjoyed it. But, I mean, I've never done this before. So when I was going about it and putting the pieces together, I didn't know that you had to have all this permission and copyrights and
I didn't either,
like,
and
I still
really don't understand the difference between being able to play it on the radio as fair use, but then you can't use it in a podcast. Like, I still have issue with that.
Yeah, so I didn't really full grasp it for maybe like the first half of the season. Was because it was always, well, you can't use that. Or I had to let them know, hey, I used this. Did you get permission? No, I didn't. I'll take it off. So, I mean, especially that one clip that we used in, I think, episode 2.
Oh, I know which one you're talking about.
Of the phone call to the hostage situation.
At the Robesonian.
At the Robesonian.
Or the Robesonian? The biggest thing we got out of the Daniel Green interview is that we've been saying Robeson County entire season. I've been saying Robeson County. First thing Daniel told me, we say Robeson. I'm like, oh.
Yeah, and it was such a great piece of audio that I wanted to. And I hope you guys looked at the notes because the link to that video was in the second episode, I think. I believe it's still there.
So episode two was when we were talking about the history of Robeson County. Mm-hmm. And two guys took the local newspaper staff hostage because they were trying to force the feds to do something about how corrupt the local sheriff was. Mm-hmm. And we had the call of them calling to WRAL mm-hmm. and saying, you know, we've got the newspaper staff held hostage. Here's what we want. Whatever you do, please don't turn us over to Hubert Stone. Right. And the radio station didn't let us use it.
Yeah. It was like an old clip. It was archived somewhere.
Yeah.
I just Google searched it, went into, nobody goes through the third or fourth, you know, page on Google. But that's all I had to do to find that audio. And once I found it, it was like discovering treasure.
Mm-hmm. I know you were really upset about that.
I was really, really upset about not having an audio. But hopefully that you guys saw that. And if you didn't, you can go back and check it out because it was such a key piece into the picture that we were trying to show you guys about how corrupt that place was, that these two men went to that length to try and show the unfairness to the Native and the Black people there in Robeson County.
Yeah, I mean, really, it was just sheer desperation. Mm-hmm. We're going to do something that's going to force the feds to pay attention. One of the things I think that makes this case so compelling is that everything is tainted by the corruption in the county. It's just Hubert Stone weaves his way through all this stuff. Mm-hmm. It goes back to, you know, people that were there before him. It just seems like it's always been a place where law enforcement has been on the take.
There was no way we could adequately tell you the story of the James Jordan murder without talking about that county and how messed up it was for decades. There was just no way, because it affected so much of the case with Operation Tarnished Badge and the corrupt police officers investigating the case. There was just no way to separate the two.
Right.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
So in episode three, we talked with Johnson Britt, mm-hmm. who prosecuted the case, I think who comes off as a very credible guy.
He was a very nice guy.
Very nice guy.
Very
convincing when you talk to him. Very charming. Mm-hmm.
And I still think he's a nice guy.
He may be, but I mean, the further you get into some of the evidence, you go back and you listen to it, I'm like, well, that's not true. That's not true.
He's very proud of that case, too.
He is.
Because we aren't, if you Google search, we're not the only place that he's talked about the James Jordan case that he won. He's been on other podcasts and done other interviews on the case. I mean, look, take your victory lap, dude. You technically won the case, and it hasn't been overturned. So, I mean, do what you got to do. He's very happy, very willing to talk. I was surprised how willing he was to talk about the case when I reached out to him.
He sat there and told us that the reason they focused on Daniel Green instead of Larry Demery was that Daniel Green had this horrible, violent history.
And he was changing his story.
And he was changing his story. And then we go to find out that Larry Demery has much more of a violent history mm-hmm. and changed his story more times.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess you take everything that everyone in this case who has, quote unquote, a side mm-hmm. says with a grain of salt. But I mean, once I started, once we got further into the details, I sort of wanted to go back and be able to talk with him again and be like, what did you mean by this? Because, you know, mm-hmm. blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. I mean, if he wants to talk, if he's listening to the podcast, I hope he'd listen to, because I feel like we were fair. We didn't, make any unsafe assumptions about the case. We just followed what the prosecution should have done. We just followed the evidence where it went.
Mm-hmm.
And if he's listening and wants to talk and wants to not really back what he said, but just listen to what Chris had to say and then want to come up with his own statement, we'd be happy to listen.
Yeah, I agree. So, as we went forward, we tried to lay out the evidence. We did some of that in three. We did that in four. We did that with the blood evidence, which was an entire episode.
What was your favorite episode?
That's a good question. I think the first one, just because it was really difficult to try to figure out how, I take that back. It's the episode either three or four, where we started talking about the evidence and trying to lay it out, because it was really difficult to figure out. And I eventually decided we have to sever the blood evidence from everything else, because there's just no way to do all of this in one episode. But I think the episodes where we go into the Larry D stuff is really the most interesting. And I think that's like one, the most listened to episode, too, is the one where we start with, is it the Johnson Britt episode?
Three is Johnson Britt.
Which episode is the blood evidence? Is that
five? We should know this. We created
it. I don't know. Whatever. But yeah, I mean, the evidence, where we start trying to lay out the evidence, and then by the time we get to the end, it's like, but then this has been, you know, this evidence has been now withdrawn, and this person signs an affidavit saying they would change their testimony, and this person says they don't know if they were blood. And then you get to the end of it, and you're like, what evidence is left? There's nothing.
Yeah. My favorite episode was episode two.
That was a good one. And Stacey St. Clair, who worked on, you know, the Dan Weider story on the Tribune, told us that she's listened to that episode multiple times.
Yeah, it was, I mean, it set the stage for me, it set the stage for everything else, which typically you would get in episode one, but episode one was just giving you an overview of what's going on and to James Jordan as a person. But episode two was setting the stage of this case was going to be messed up from the get-go because of how it was in this county. So that was my favorite episode. And I think it was my favorite episode to create, because I got to set a scene with sound.
Well, you put in some like kick-ass dueling banjos music, which was great.
Yeah, and that shout out to Russ, our guy Russ. We're actually in his studio recording this now, Matera, I didn't know what to do in terms of how to do any of this. I had no prior experience doing any of this in terms of putting pieces together and making it sound good. Russ helped me out a lot, gave me a lot of advice.
Yeah, you had swamp sounds and like all kinds of stuff.
Yeah,
in there.
He gave me the company's website to find sound that we can use that wasn't copyrighted.
That wasn't illegal.
That wasn't illegal. He gave me access to that, told me how to go about it. So, yeah, shout outs to Russ for helping me with that.
So here's how we would do an episode typically, because I had a lot of people ask this. Mm-hmm. I would figure out what that episode, and I would talk about it with Tony. Here's what I think we should talk about this week. Then I start pulling through. I have this huge freaking Redwell. I carry it around with me.
Yeah, it was crazy.
I drop it all the time.
It was crazy.
It's got all the court documents in it. It's got all the research in it, all our notes, interviews, transcripts, everything. And I would craft an episode, and I would write it out as like a script. And then I would put things in there like dramatic music, and we would record it, just the audio, and then Tony would have the job of turning it into something that people actually want to listen to. So Tony takes it from just this you know, and I would say things like, one time I put dramatic music.
Yeah.
I would put like, you know, bombshell music, you know, stuff like that, because I could kind of hear how I wanted it to sound in my head, but I have no idea how to translate to that to actual audio. So then Tony would take it and he'd have it for like 3 days, and then he would give it back to me and it sounded like a professional podcast. It was amazing.
If I have all the pieces that I need, I can usually figure something out.
Because you're also really talented, and you would say things like, I can just hear it in my head. I mean, that's a gift.
Yeah, I mean, I learned a lot from Chris Tannehill, who is the station's
another
and probably
the
world's
station, yeah.
best sound man. I'm basically like a learner of Chris Tannehill
Here's
and a
Padawan.
Follower of Chris Tannehill. And I have, over the years, you know, it's funny how things work out, getting you prepared for things that you need to do. Being grateful enough to watch Chris Tannehill as he worked, as I interned here. Then I started to work here. And just watching him work and asking him questions about how does he make his opens and stuff. Because that's what Chris does every day. Just in a smaller kind of a minute and a half session. He does what I did with the podcast, is create a story in a certain amount of time where everybody can get it and understand what you're talking about with sound.
Yeah.
Chris is amazing at that. And that's what I kind of wanted to do.
Well, and I would even say to you, like, I love the first season of Serial. Please listen to the first season of Serial and tell me, you know, and see if we can. And you could listen to it and then try to, like, imitate it, but still have, like, our own sound that didn't sound like we were trying to rip off Serial.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Serial was...
Which I totally was.
Was definitely a motivational piece in how we went about it.
Shout out to Sarah Koenig.
But again, I didn't want to replicate Serial. That's their own thing. This was ours.
Well, yeah, and it was also, this is Chicago. It's basketball. It's more hip-hoppy. It's, you know, I mean, it's just different than, you know, a Baltimore childhood, you know, relationship gone wrong kind of thing. It was completely different.
Yeah, so hopefully people enjoyed how it, and once I got the first couple episodes down, I was like, okay, I have a pattern now. I know how I want to go about doing this and telling the stories. When Julie would put like, oh, bombshell music here, I knew that this was an important part of the episode and it needed to be dramatized as much as possible. So I hope it came across. That was the one thing I was concerned about. I was like, I don't want to have this part be corny or cheesy.
You didn't want to put like dun-dun-dun in there.
Right. I want it to be, because it was serious.
It was serious.
So I wanted to make sure the respect came across, but also the seriousness of it with the music, with the sound effects and stuff like that. I wanted it to be nice and acceptable to the ears and the mind.
But then also it has to stand out. I mean, so like when we got the document saying that Larry Demery now says he recants his testimony and he's never seen, he never saw Daniel Green pull the trigger. It's sort of like, I mean, if you had put like, you know, Beethoven in there, I would have, I mean, it's to me, it's like impossible to overstate that moment on the podcast, but I thought you did a great job with it.
I have a couple questions for you.
All right.
Now, this podcast would be nothing if Julie didn't do the research and the writing of the script of it. I need the pieces. Julie created the pieces to be had and to be dealt with. So thank you for that first of all. But I remember even some we would record late and you would have to write the script, staying up, you know, all times of the night trying to finish the script out. How was that process of writing a script? And were you used to writing things like that?
No.
Or was this like something different?
No, it was totally different. First of all, I'm trying to write like I talk, which is like, you know, and then I try to write like you talk, because we never knew who was going to read what part.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to sort of make, I don't want it to sound like scholarly
legal. I made small edits in the parts that
that's totally fine. Yeah. I wanted it to sound like we sound. Mm-hmm. That's what I think makes podcasts so accessible, is it's just someone telling you a story.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was, what was difficult was all the different information in this case. And it just, and it's evolving while we're doing the podcast. I mean, we didn't have that evidence about Larry Demery recanting his testimony until episode 7.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you know, it was constantly in flux. We were constantly having to rewrite it. And just trying to figure out how to organize it was tough.
Mm-hmm.
So what I did with the final episode, I mean, normally I would just sit down and I'm like, all right, and I just start telling the story. And I cut and I paste audio in and stuff like that. But when I did the Daniel Green episode, I just took his interview, put it in a Word doc, and then just started writing around it. And that was much easier. So, you know, I feel like this podcast basically just taught us how to do a podcast.
Yeah.
So next season, maybe that's something that I revert to a little bit more. Mm-hmm. But I always sat there like, oh, I've got to tell you about this, and I got to tell you about that. Now, oh, what about this? And it was difficult to try to lay it out in a way that the audience could follow. So I hope that we did that, because it is an incredibly convoluted, difficult case with people giving and taking back information all the time. So at the end, to be like, well, where are we in this, was sort of like my main concern, that we all came out of it sort of with an understanding.
Did your, as if you don't know, Julie was a public defender, and I would say a good one.
I hope so.
So did, as you're going through these files and stuff like that, did your lawyer mind kind of take over at certain points?
For sure.
Like, did you put yourself in the situation, oh, I would have done this, or I would have done that, or it's like, wait, this doesn't seem right to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, as a public defender, you learn to read through police reports and read through trial transcripts and look for the mistakes. So I think that, because that's what you're going to probably use on appeal. That's what you're going to use to try to defend your client, the police mistakes, the prosecutor mistakes. So that definitely sort of kicked back in. It was really nice to dive back into it. I mean, there was one night I was like sitting down with like a glass of wine and 8,400 pages of trial testimony. And I was like, yeah, I haven't done this for so long. So it was really nice to sort of dip back into it in that way, but also not have the responsibility of whether or not someone's going to go to jail based on what I did. So being able to just sort of critique other people was really, I mean, it's like, it's a total shitty thing to do, but it was kind of fun. I mean, you know, and there wasn't tons of stress in it for us because someone else is handling the case.
Right.
So it was fun to just kind of sit there and sort of like eat popcorn and watch the whole thing unfold.
It was certainly fun doing this podcast. I'm going to appreciate the small break that we get. With this, because it was kind of like, okay, what are we doing?
Well,
this
we
week?
Already have a meeting set up for season two, which we still have to figure out.
Yeah,
what
I mean,
we're doing.
Yeah, it's. I guess we can get to that a little bit later because we still got some stuff to discuss. But yeah, the coming together, the pieces coming together, and then it all ended up working out. People started to take this podcast seriously. Chris Mumma, which I thought would be difficult to get her on, honestly. Those, was it 2 weeks where we were just kind of in a stalemate where we were just discussing the case?
And they were like, do you have to, so they're like, are you putting out an episode this week? And we were like, well, we're kind of waiting. Yeah. And they're like, well, can you do something? And we were like, I guess. So it's just us talking basically about how we're waiting. That was episode six.
Yeah.
We're just waiting to talk about whether or not we're going to get Chris Mumma on.
Yeah. And I guess maybe we can plan that a little bit better in the next season on those kind of stalling points in a story if we're telling a story that's still ongoing.
Yeah. Well, especially when people say, yeah, I'll talk to you, but I can't do it for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
You're kind of like, I have a podcast due on Monday. So, I mean, definitely. And I think, like we said earlier, the audio held us up a little bit because I wanted to be like 4 weeks ahead of what we were putting out. And
we just didn't get to be able to do that. Yeah, we basically had what we wanted to present maybe, what did you say, a month before we actually dropped.
Mm-hmm.
So we were, but again, layers had to be stripped. Permissions needed to be asked. Things need to be set up on our websites and stuff like that. So it was very done haphazardly, I think was the word used.
But we'll be better organized.
But yeah, we would definitely be better organized next time.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
So as we're going through the case in the middle of the season, the evidence we presented. So what is the biggest piece of evidence that you thought was the game changer?
Well, before I say that, I want to just clarify for people two things that have come up in the last week.
Yes.
One of them was something that we didn't get until after we had posted the episode already. And I put them on, I tweeted it out, and I also put it on Instagram, is that we got documents from the DEA talking about the fact that Larry Deese was well known to be dealing out of Crestline Mobile Homes, which is where he worked with Larry Demery, which is a mile down the road from Gum Swamp where James Jordan's body was found.
So it wasn't just a false claim or a rumor.
It wasn't a rumor.
Or just run of the mill, like Johnson Britt decided to paint that picture of every county or every city has drug problems.
Right. And it wasn't just Chris and Daniel saying, well, there's drug dealing at Crestline Mobile Homes.
Right.
We saw a DEA report and I tweeted it out, and it's also on my Instagram page that I drew an arrow right to the line where it says that Larry Deese, the sheriff's son, was dealing drugs out of Crestline Mobile Homes, and everybody knew it. So I think that gives credibility to what Daniel said about Larry Demery having the job of driving in front of the mobile homes and transporting cocaine that way. The other thing, and I'm not sure that this came through very well last week, but when Daniel Green was talking about seeing James Jordan's body for the first time, he's talking about it being outside the car. So he says the body was in this like grassy area, but it wasn't in the car. And I'm not sure if that came through or if he sort of clarified that later and we didn't put that clip in. But he says when he found the body, it was laying in the grass when they found the body.
So according to Daniel's account, I shouldn't say that, but according to him and his account of the situation, James Jordan was already dead when he got there.
Yes.
And he wasn't in the car dead. He was on the floor in the ground, in the grassy area, as Daniel
near the hotel. So, and the reason that resonates with me is because remember the issue with the bullet hole in the shirt that wasn't there and then was there?
Mm-hmm.
There was those three holes at the bottom of the shirt that the coroner said would have lined up with a bullet hole if the shirt was pulled up, like as if you were in a struggle and someone's pulling on your shirt. So to me, that resonates. the biggest evidence to me still is the fact that Larry Demery now says he never saw Daniel Green pull the trigger. Mm-hmm. And how he can recant that testimony and the judge can still say no new trial is lost on me. I mean, Larry Demery has nothing to gain by saying that. He risks a perjury charge mm-hmm. by doing it. So to me, that was just the biggest bombshell the entire season.
I'm going to have to agree. before that, I guess it was the blood evidence for me before that huge piece of evidence. But yeah, I mean, if you have a statement, I don't know if I'm trying to remember, did she sign an affidavit saying that it was true?
I don't know if she signed an affidavit. She gave an interview.
Okay.
Like, yeah.
The state forensics person is what we're talking about. That was big for me. It's because if the person, the expert, is now saying, well, at the time in the early parts of DNA collection, I couldn't really give you a definite answer. And if I were to do that with the knowledge that I have today, I would say I can't tell you if there was blood in the car.
Yeah, well, what happened was she didn't get the confirmation there was blood in the car, but she still said, in my opinion, there is, which is mm-hmm. like a big problem if you're mm-hmm. a scientist. You don't get to say, you know, we can't prove that there's an asteroid coming towards Earth, but in my opinion, there is.
Because nobody can, the jury, especially the common person, is not going to have doubts about your testimony
right.
when you say that. I don't know if the police even get that type of just acceptance of whatever you say is fact. You are a scientist. And again, how it was at that time. She had a job to do. Her job was for the state, even though technically she doesn't supposed mm-hmm. to work for the state. But that's how it ended up working out. And I'm not going to blame her for it. That's just how it was.
But, you know, I don't remember if I said this on the Locked On Bulls podcast we were on together or if I said this mm-hmm. on another one. But remember the scene. Have you seen Pulp Fiction, Tony? OK, this is an ongoing issue with Tony. OK, so there's a scene in Pulp Fiction where they're sitting really close to a guy in the car and they accidentally shoot him and like blow his head off. And it's like the blood, you know, it's just like 1 minute the guy's talking and the next minute it's just like an explosion of blood mm-hmm. in the car. Okay, granted, different kinds of guns, different kinds of bullets, whatever. But the idea that you could shoot someone in the chest at point-blank range and there would be no blood anywhere in the car,
yeah.
to me, is just ridiculous. Like, yeah. I mean, it doesn't even pass the common sense test.
But if a scientist is telling you that, I mean, what are you gonna?
And it wasn't even in the driver's seat where he's supposedly yeah. sitting. It was in the passenger seat.
yeah.
Come on.
Yeah, I mean, if it were me, I would be like, okay, whatever they say goes, because they are on the side of science and on the side of logic. And that's how the prosecution built their case. Outside of Demery's testimony, quote unquote, it was the blood evidence.
Yeah, you're right. And it's disappointing. I mean, this is a problem we've had all across America. We talked about this before, that state forensic labs believe they are an extension of the prosecution, which they're not supposed to be. Mm-hmm. I thought that was huge evidence that Jennifer Elwell has now. I mean, the judge, Judge Weeks in the case, recanting his, or not recanting, but basically saying if he had known the relationship between Larry Deese and the sheriff, he would have allowed that evidence in.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know at that point how anybody could not have known about the relationship. I mean, it seems it was news everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
What did you think about Daniel's interview last week?
I was not a part of that interview. I was doing Cubs baseball at the time. So Julie was one-on-one with Daniel Green there, and it was a very good interview, Julie.
Thank you. It was him talking. But.
Yeah, it was. I mean, you asked the proper questions, the correct questions to get the answers that we needed and the audience wanted to hear from him. So thank you for that. I thought Daniel was very forthcoming. And what I mean by that is he knew the mistakes he made to get him to that point. Not saying that whatever happened should have landed him in jail for that long, but he recognized that his decision making didn't help anything. His loyalty to Larry, he acknowledged that I was too loyal and too trusting of a person.
And I think that was really touching when he talked about why he was so loyal mm-hmm. to him that he was the only, you know, was his friend. He came from a new school. He felt unwanted there. Uh-huh. And Larry was his only friend. And then, you know, late when he was in prison unjustly, yep. Again, when he was 15 years old, that Larry was the one who called him and wrote him letters. And I mean, mm-hmm. their friendship would be a really touching story if it hadn't gone so wrong.
Yeah. He mentioned going back to when he was wrongfully convicted for the axe situation. He said Larry was the only guy. And that was poignant to me. He's like, mm-hmm. he was the only guy, because Daniel grew up with a mom and his grandma and his sister. So he was surrounded by women mm-hmm. all the time. And not having a father figure or any strong male figures in his life, he found a friend that was there for him. And he stuck by that friend.
Yeah.
And his friend, through that current situation where he was wrongfully convicted of the axe thing, would write him and call him all the time. I don't know how many people would do that.
Yeah.
If somebody went to prison, you usually get forgotten. You kind of get left out on your own. And nobody understands the situation that, I mean, he talked about what he had to learn and what he had to go through during his first instance in prison. It's crazy. It's crazy. I would assume it's crazy for a 15-year-old to end up in prison.
In prison, not in juvie.
Not in juvie, yeah. In prison with a bunch of other grown men.
Right. And, you know, and I don't know how much we went into this or if this really came through and what he was saying, but the woman who represented Daniel in that case wound up becoming a prosecutor, I think, in another county, like mm-hmm. maybe like the county next door or something like that. And the allegations are that at the end of her time as an attorney, before she was going to become a prosecutor, she just pled out all her cases because she wanted to get out of there, finish her cases. A lot of times judges won't let you get out of a case until it's finished. So she allegedly just wanted to be done and move on to her next job. So setting a case for trial that maybe is going to happen for 5 months or 6 months, depending on the caseload, is probably something she wasn't that interested in doing. So he really felt like he put his trust in her to defend him and to tell him what the right things to do. And instead, she pled him out mm-hmm. And he wound up going to jail instead of putting on a trial with a self-defense verdict, mm-hmm. Which wound up being found ineffective assistance of counsel. The judge said it was clearly self-defense, that he was, you know, the reason he hit the guy that was running at him with the handle of an axe is because the guy was trying to attack him, and it should have been a self-defense case all along, and threw it out.
That's 2 years.
2 years to spend in prison. A teenager.
2 years of his life gone
yeah.
on a case that shouldn't have gone that far at all.
I agree.
Like, how do you can't get that back.
Right.
Like, you've already seen the things. You've already experienced the things.
Yeah.
And it's crazy there are no... I mean, they just say sorry,
mm-hmm.
and now you got to find a job. Now you got to find a skill. You missed 2 years of high school. You got to go find an education somewhere. And it's all on you. It's not like they are obligated to help you.
Yeah, and you don't get a letter saying, oops, our bad. Please ignore this violent felony right. on his record. I mean, that doesn't happen. You are the one to try to explain it away.
Right.
Yeah, it's not fair.
It's not. It's not. I thought Chris was going to say or interrupt a lot more than what she did. She only did it twice mm-hmm. in the hour that you guys mm-hmm. were talking. So that means he was prepared.
Mm-hmm.
He knew now you can say, well, he's had a long time to have a story, have a plan, and he's been saying the same story now for a while. So he had a long time to figure out what he was going to say and stuff like that. But I thought it was genuine and honest. He's a very nice guy.
He does seem like a very nice guy.
He seems like a very, very nice guy. But you can tell that he's kind of not let the prison lifestyle affect him.
Yeah, well, he says, you know, he doesn't gamble, he doesn't drink, he doesn't do drugs, he doesn't do a lot of the stuff that's going on in prison. One of the things I thought was really interesting, though, and I think, you know, this is a guy who's been screwed over by the justice system, to his mind, twice.
Mm-hmm.
So every time the phone would click, and I think it actually might have been me clicking my pen. I think I was going like this with my pen near the mic. He'd stop and he'd go, hello. And so I know you're always telling me to stop like going mm-hmm over people.
Yeah.
And I was trying not to do it. But if I didn't do it, he would stop and he'd think that we got cut off.
The phone was dropped.
Yeah. And he thought the phone, that someone was listening in.
Mm-hmm.
And which, I mean, you know, why anyone would still be interested in this case 20 years on, I don't know why someone on the prosecution side would still be interested in it. But he was very concerned about that. And I think that You know, that's what happens, I think, when you feel like there's the legal system is not trustworthy at all.
Looking at this case, it really unveiled the truth of our justice system. I mean, you said it before, his defense attorney on his first case, she just wanted to get out.
Mm-hmm.
So she pled him out.
Yeah.
I mean, not to laugh at that situation, but it's just crazy to think that even in the seriousness of what this is, of what going to court and going to prison is, it's still a game to a lot of people involved in terms of trying to move on, trying to take
steps up
to the next level in your career. But there's still people's lives. And it's not like our business right now where we talk sports and stuff like that. And if we're good at it, we get hosting jobs and stuff like that. We're not in charge of the lives of other people. And you being a defense attorney, which now I have a deeper appreciation for what you did, Julie, so thank you. that people go, that's an everyday thing. And people's lives are in the hands of other people. Now, albeit to, I mean, if you make a mistake, hey, or if you do a crime, that's what happens, that's what you get. But it just seems like it should be taken more seriously than just this is a career move for me.
And don't underestimate the amount of stress that people go through when you're being convicted, when you're being charged with a crime and you keep having to come back to court over and over and over. And you don't know every time is my, you know, because when I was a public defender, and I'm sure it's different in every county, but, you know, we would come up every day with 10, 15 cases set for trial. And then a bunch of them would get pled out and eventually there'd be four cases for trial and one would go to trial and the other three would all get continued. If you're a person and you don't know every time you go to court, am I going to go to jail today? And then, you know, you're looking at 5 years and suddenly someone says to you, look, if we plead guilty, they're going to give you 6 months. You'll be out in three. This whole thing will be over. To a lot of people, that is preferable to dragging out the agony of not knowing, am I going to go to prison for 5 years? So there's a lot of people that will jump at that kind of stuff. And I wonder how much of that situation Daniel was in as well, because initially he thought he was going to be out in 6 months and he wound up being there for 2 years.
My father always told me, if you get in trouble and you didn't do it, never say you did it. And just never say, even if you found guilty, if you didn't do it, never say you did it. And that's something that, you know, I still think about today. If I ever get caught up in a situation and unfortunately, and I know I didn't do it, it's just in me not to say that I did it. But I can see how you can come to that realization, like, look, I can't keep doing this all the time. What's the least that I can get here?
Yep.
Like, the least amount of time, I can give you 6 months, you'll be out in three. Okay, I think I can do that. Okay, let's do it. Like, if
and
your
especially
lawyer,
when you're a 15-year-old kid.
Yeah, and your lawyer is, he's supposed to be your advisor, right? And they're telling you all these things. It's like, who else do you have to go to talk about it?
Right. No, that's exactly right. And especially a 15-year-old, I mean, your brain doesn't even start developing complete reasoning skills until you're like 25 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, he's 15 years old. His brain is still developing. He doesn't know anything about the legal system or what to do. Mm-hmm. And here's someone in a position of authority telling him what to do. He did it.
So we get to the end of all this. And we need to discuss what we think happened.
Mm-hmm.
To James Jordan on that night.
Do you have a theory?
Yeah, I can go first because you're more informed on this than I am. I think James liked to go out a lot on his own, which the family has confirmed. That's still a bit weird to me. But everybody's family dynamic is different in how they get over and how they make things work. I know if I haven't talked to or seen my father in days, something would come up. Even after one day, I haven't talked to him, haven't seen him.
Mm-hmm.
That would bother me, just me personally. But again, everybody's family dynamic is different on how they make things work. So I can't judge or anything like that. I think he was in the wrong spot at the wrong time. And I do think Larry had a pickup that he's supposed to be made. Jordan had a nice enough car. If James had an average car, I don't think he gets bothered. But you're in the business of drugs. You see a lot of people with big fancy cars who sell drugs. You're supposed to be picking up something from in relation to drugs. You see that car. You get closer. You see what he has on. You think he's the guy. James maybe says, hey, I don't know what you're talking about. Larry maybe doesn't believe him. As we know, as we kind of went through this case, we can kind of paint a picture of how Larry's like psyche is, especially from Daniel's testimony on his friend or ex-friend or wherever that dynamic is. And I think Larry shoots him. I don't know if it's on purpose or on accident. Maybe he tries to flex a little bit, show, hey, get out this car. I know what's in here. I have to get it to where it needs to go. I think maybe he shoots him accidentally with James outside of the car as they kind of discuss what's going on. And I think that's how it went down. And I think he asks his friend Daniel for help. And Daniel ended up being the guy to serve the time for it.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I think, too. Just to expound upon it a little bit. And again, this is my personal opinion. I'm not saying any of this is fact.
Yes, personal opinion.
Larry Demery worked at Crestline Mobile Homes. He knew Larry Deese. Larry Deese was a known cocaine trafficker. Larry told Daniel, according to Daniel, that he was getting, he was protected through his dealings with Larry Deese from being arrested on an outstanding warrant. Daniel also said that Larry Demery owed them money because he'd been caught skimming drugs off the top, and so they were making him do all this stuff. There's documentation that Larry called his cousin in New York that night, said he was coming up to drop off a package. I think the exact same thing. I think Larry Demery went to, I don't think that it was a side of the road. I think that James Jordan pulled into the parking lot of the Quality Inn or somewhere around the Quality Inn, which was about 200 yards, 500 yards from where the side of the road allegedly was. I mean, in the side of the road thing, like them insisting that he's on the side of the road, I mean, you found him in a swamp and you found the car somewhere else. So how do you get to like living and dying on him being on the side of the road?
Right.
It doesn't even make sense. I mean, so I think that James Jordan pulled over. I agree. I think he's in the wrong place at the wrong time. I think he pulled into the Quality Inn parking lot. I think he was napping. I think that Larry Demery came to pick up the car, that he thought that was the car because it was a Lexus with gold rims. That when, you know, that there was some kind of get me. At some point we heard something about give me the keys. I don't know if that came from Daniel. I can't remember. But there was some kind of give me the keys. What are you talking about? Exchange. Maybe Larry grabs him and drags him out of the car. There's a struggle. James Jordan gets shot. Larry Demery panics, runs back to get Daniel to come help him fix the situation. And that's what I think happened.
Yeah, I mean, was it too far-fetched for the prosecution to think that?
It seems, you know, it seems like there's a lot of mental gymnastics involved to put Daniel Green at the scene. I mean, really all you have is Larry Demery's testimony, and then you're trying to bolster all his testimony. I mean, the gun, they never found the gun that was used in that case. They did find another. They didn't have a ballistics test, so they couldn't tell if it was the same gun or not. But the gun supposedly had been used by Larry Demery in a robbery, an armed robbery, and then was in the room where he was sleeping at Daniel's mom's house. So how you tie that gun to Daniel Green, I don't know. And Larry Demery's the guy that was robbing people.
Yeah. Daniel certainly doesn't seem like the violent one.
No.
Here.
No.
And if I was on that defense team, the first part, obviously Chris is doing an amazing job right now with Daniel's case. But, I mean, I know they're friends, but you got to, if your job is to defend Daniel, you got to put Larry as a, is he credible?
Oh, I don't think he's. I mean, there's nothing to back up his testimony. I mean, absolutely nothing. The blood evidence, no. The gun, no. There's nothing. I mean, there's nothing to even show that James Jordan was shot in the car. The whole thing, this story to me is so much more plausible and is much more supported by the evidence. I mean, I don't know. It's frustrating to look back on this and just say all you had to do was follow the evidence.
Yeah.
And people in the county have said, you know, the whole world was looking at us because of, you know, it was Michael Jordan's dad and it was like a big circus. I mean, maybe if this isn't Michael Jordan's father, it gets solved in a more reasonable way.
I don't know.
And I mean, we started, I mean, we came at this completely objectionable, completely objective. I didn't want, and this is not what I wanted to find out doing this podcast, that like, in my mind, a miscarriage of justice has been done. And you don't have to believe that Daniel Green had nothing to do with it to look at the evidence and say he didn't get a fair trial. And this is where I stand on Adnan Syed. This is where I stand on Making a Murderer. It's that even if you're not sure who did it, you've got to look at this and say this was not a fair trial.
Yeah,
let's have another trial and let's figure out what actually freaking happened here and what's supported by the evidence. Yeah,
you mentioned that maybe if the case wasn't Michael Jordan, that maybe they figure it out. I don't think so. How messed up that county was. Nothing was done right. I mean, all right, even before they knew what the body was, look how it was handled.
Yeah,
it was put on the back of a truck to sit.
If it's not Michael Jordan, maybe it's not solved at all. Maybe there's nobody.
Right. I mean, it's just they burn it. Bury the shirt. Yeah, just get the dead body out from the public.
Our listeners were so fascinated by the buried shirt. They just couldn't. I mean, I many people talked to me about that.
I was too. But I mean, we did an interview on the Locked On Bulls podcast. So if you want to check that out. With Matt Peck and Jordan Malley, and where we talked about the case, I may mention that this county was the absolute worst county to have this go down in because of the corruption, because of the routines of the various people involved in that case. They were not prepared for a case this size. They weren't even prepared for the other cases that they had to adequately have justice in that county. And as we said in episode two and presented episode two, they had a history of that. I don't know if they just panicked because, look, if you're not prepared for the test and the test comes, I don't get how they get a pass.
Well, I don't think it's that much of a priority. I mean, how many people are looking at the poorest county in North Carolina to see how they treat minority teenagers?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, probably not very many people. I mean, as long as, you know, the people running the show were happy, that was probably all that mattered. Mm-hmm. You know, another thing I wanted to say was that, you know, the phone call to Larry Deese from James Jordan's car after he had been murdered, to me, is such a huge moment in this case. Whether or not he talked to Larry Deese, just the fact that Larry Demery made the call to Larry Deese, to me, is telling. Whether it's, what do you want me to do now? Here's what happened. Or whether it's, I know a guy who can tell me how to get rid of a body. And I think that, you know, and Chris Mumma told us that every single interview is in the file except for the police Deese. Interview of Larry Deese.
Mm-hmm.
I think Chris Mumma was absolutely right that bringing Larry Deese into this case complicated it. Whether or not you believe that he had anything to do with it, I think it complicated the story.
I think to them, it may have complicated it. I think it paints a clear picture. The more people that you know are involved, it just, again, going back to how I put the pieces together. I just need all the pieces.
Mm-hmm.
Just lay them out. I just need all the pieces. I can figure it out later. They were actively trying to shoo away pieces that would help make the picture better or clearer just because it was going to mess up the theory that they already had and were ready to present.
We should also add that Larry Deese has been interviewed, at least through his attorney, a couple times, and he has denied any involvement in this case repeatedly. So we should just put that out there.
So is there anything that you wish we would have done with this season that we didn't get a chance to or didn't just think of?
I wish we would have gotten a chance to talk to Larry Demery. We tried to do that through Hugh Rogers and also to talk to Larry Demery's mother and didn't really get anywhere. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to talk to Connie Brayboy, who was the person who reached out to us on Facebook, who told us that that Larry Demery had confessed to her that Daniel Green had nothing to do with it. And then
that's something we didn't mention during this episode was the amount of witnesses that were told by Larry Demery that he actually did it.
Yeah.
And again, Connie Brayboy reaching out.
And she was the editor of a newspaper. Yeah. So, I mean, to me, her testimony carries a lot of weight. she's supposed to be objective in these situations. And she's a member of the Lumbee community, mm-hmm. like Larry. So it's like sort of, you know, going against someone in her community. And I think that people don't generally tend to do that without a reason.
Daniel, the young lady that was with Daniel.
Bobby Joe Murillo.
Bobby Joe Murillo, who wanted to speak out. But again, these are all young people. Mm-hmm. 17, 18, and still living at home.
And being told by their parents, stay out of it,
which...
I will never understand.
I get it, though. I get it, though. If you don't want your child involved in a murder case, I get it. I understand.
But Daniel
it.
Green is someone's child, too.
I think it goes to the as long as mine is okay. You never have that when push comes to shove and the heat is on like that. You just want to protect yours.
I feel like one of the things about motherhood, though, is that every child sort of becomes your child. You know what I mean? I think you see other people as other people's children. You see other people as other people's children, if that makes sense. And I don't know. I mean, obviously, I don't know the people involved in this case. I don't know what their relationships are like with their children. But for me, it's the exact opposite. I would have said, I want my child to be safe, but these are someone's children's too, and they need to be protected as well.
That's especially considering everybody knew how corrupt that police department and justice system was. So I get why. Don't turn on these police officers. They will make your lives really, really bad. So I get that fear of, hey, don't protect him. Just let them do what they're going to do. You stay out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And what are you going to say? You're a 17-year-old.
Yeah, that's fair.
So, but yeah. Anything else?
No, I just think it's interesting that we both came down on the side of I think Daniel Green's version is more credible.
I wish that we probably should have tried to get a statement from the Jordan family or Michael, even if it, hey, we don't want to comment on anything. I wish we would have had that quote or something sent to us. Maybe that's something that we'll do next time.
Yeah, I mean, Michael Jordan, their family has not even responded to requests to be interviewed about this in the past.
Yeah, that's something that Chris was saying that we didn't put it in the episode, but she was saying that the Jordan family and Michael Jordan doesn't want anything to do with this case whatsoever. They've already kind of had their grieving period. Mm-hmm. They don't want to rehash anything to them. The killers are in jail, and they have moved on.
Well, and Chris said that she would like to meet with Michael Jordan or anyone from that family and say, just hear us out. Just hear what we have to say. You know, I had a guy call into the show last night and say, you need to leave James Jordan alone. Let him rest in peace. And I said, well, I don't really think anyone's resting in peace if there's an innocent guy in jail. Mm-hmm. And the guy said, his killers are in jail. Let him burn in hell. Let him rest in peace. And I think a lot of people sort of had that attitude, which goes back to what Kyle Swenson and Chris Mumma both said, which is once we put someone behind bars, we're done with it. We don't want to think about it anymore. It's hard to think about the fact that someone may be in jail for 23 years that doesn't belong there. It's hard to wrap your mind around. And to me, I thought about reaching out to their representative, and I think we reached out to ask if we could, because the NBA wouldn't let us use,
audio
unless
audio.
Michael said it was okay.
Yeah.
And they didn't respond to that. Mm-hmm. For me, a lot of it was about what information can people add to this, because we were dealing with such a short period of time. Mm-hmm. You know, does Michael Jordan's family have evidence they can add to the case that helps with the understanding of it? I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there wasn't anyone there that night. The stuff that came in at trial were stipulations just about this is his jewelry, these are his glasses, whatever. So part of it, too, was trying to figure out who was going to give us the best information in the shortest amount of time. So there were time constraints as well.
My final question for us is... why do you think the judge refuses to see the evidence and have Daniel have a new trial? Just your theories and opinions, since this is a theories and opinions episode.
Theories are that, you know, it's really difficult to overturn criminal convictions anyway. Judges don't like to do it. I've never seen a case with so many red flags as this one. I thought this was a shoe-in, at least for the hearing, if not a new trial. Judges work together. Legal communities are tight-knit legal communities. There's a lot of politics involved. I don't think they necessarily want people looking back and saying, wow, you guys really screwed this one up. You know, and I think that when cases like this happen, the community sort of circles the wagons. I mean, that happened out in DuPage County when we had a guy who was on death row for I don't even know how many years. It's funny the way that people become resistant to admitting there were mistakes. So, I mean, I can only speculate. But if ever there was a case where it feels like there should be a new trial, this is the one.
That's scary. that's scary. And I get why people don't want the death penalty around.
Mm-hmm.
Because of situations like this. If it was just, hey, you were found guilty, we get to put you to death, there'd be an innocent man dead. And it's plenty of cases of the American justice system messing up that way. And which is really weird because, because you would be more trustworthy with the people if you were able to admit your mistakes on a more consistent basis. And I don't know why they don't find value in that. People need to believe in the justice system or you're going to otherwise you're going to have riots. You're going to have these things because people don't trust police. People don't trust the justice system to treat them fairly, especially a certain segment of the population in America. That is a strong belief. The justice system isn't built for others.
Right. And what a great way, if you're really concerned about the reputation that Robeson County has based on its history, what a great way to sort of turn the page by saying, we're going to go back and clean up this mess.
Yes.
I think that would be something that would be looked upon favorably by people rather than, oh, you guys really messed up.
Yeah. I mean, you may get those comments, but they can't say you're not trustworthy.
Right.
That you're not able to admit when you're wrong and say sorry and apologize. They can't say those things. I'd rather have somebody say, oh, you messed up versus, oh, I can't trust this person or this person.
When you know better, you
have
to do better.
Yeah.
And if you know this case was unjust, you are bound by, if you're an attorney, if you're a judge, by your oath to the state constitution.
It should be just
to go in.
Human moral.
I agree.
Code.
I agree.
You're in positions of power that can change things for the better, and not doing that or ignoring it is a problem. Is people trust you when they vote you in to take care of them and be honest. And when you're out just looking for yourself, it's just messed up.
Yeah, it is. It's really messed up. So there's a petition, a change.org petition out there to try to get the attorney general to order a new trial in this case. I don't know exactly how the law works in North Carolina, but that's something that is being petitioned for. Also, you know, I think that in doing this podcast, we really hoped that people will share it far and wide, that it'll maybe help bring some attention to this case. Because at this point, despite not knowing what I thought when I went into it, I really do feel like there is been an egregious wrong committed in this case.
Yeah. Thank you guys for checking out our first season of The Score Behind the Headlines. We are currently working in trying to figure out what we're going to do for season two. Radio.com wanted a season two. I didn't think they would want a season two.
Why not?
But I thought they were just saying, hey, this is a nice little thing. This is a good one-off. But people like the way we tell stories. So that's a compliment, right?
I think so. Either that or they just want us to fill content on the site. But either way,
we'll get
to do another one.
But yeah, we get to do another one and tell another great story, which we haven't figured out just yet.
I could not ask for a better partner, Tony. I mean, I know it's like we're different races, we're different ages. Like, you haven't seen any movies that I've seen.
I don't.
But for some reason, when it comes to this kind of stuff, we just sort of were on the same page from the beginning. And so it's been really great to work with you, and I can't wait to start season two.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. It's going to be great. It may be about murder. Julie loves the murder.
I do love murder. Tony does not love murder.
I do not love murder.
So we'll see.
but thank you guys for enjoying it. Please share. By word of mouth. Don't just, also social media helps. But if you are friends with people, tell them you found this great podcast that tells great stories. And we hope you guys stick with us through the next season. So, Julie, any last words?
Nope.
All right. I guess that's it. I guess you can follow us on Twitter at TonyGill670, at Julie DeCaro, and at 670 Score for any updates and for updates about the oncoming season and any additional information that we may kind of find or given to us about this case. We will definitely share and tweet those out and share those with you guys that are interested. But thank you guys again for listening. Make sure you like, rate, share, subscribe.
We'll see you in season things. Two.
We'll see you in season two, right?
When you're living on the street of forgotten souls.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.